accession number 18439, Reel 2.
Albert Tyus, Reel 2. How much firing had you done by then in the battle?
Well, I was in the slit trench with rifleman John McGuigan, and we had two boxes of hand grenades. And John was observing, and we kept intermittent firing 303s at shapes we could see down the hill running about. And he said, when I tell you, lob a few grenades, right, it's a hand grenades, and we throw one each down the hill onto the upcoming Chinese, obviously the Chinese, and then we fired a few volleys and a few salvos and 303s. Many times we'd be firing at haphazard, where we thought we saw people moving or the bushes moving on the way up, and that was it, I should say. I didn't name the number of rounds I fired, it'd be very difficult, but we did fire at shapes running up the hill and the likes of, and we also threw the two boxes of hand grenades without any problems. Then in the in the early dawn, we came off the hill, and that's when the real good fuselage of mortar bombs came at us and did the most damage to the platoon, killing, as I say, practically killing rifleman Winterskill. And then I took Winterskill down the hill where I've explained he died. And I also went back with him down to the MSR and to see if he really was dead. The sergeant major said, get back up to your platoon and see what's happening. And that was it. The platoon then had come off the hill and then went back on. And in the full light of day, full light of morning, the men who were back in the slit trenches, in the foxholes, were in a back position, in as much that the Chinese troops had exposed themselves on Kamaksan, and they were looking down in a high position onto our hilltop, which was adjacent to Kamakstan, and they were, every time anybody put their head up, they were targets for the Chinese snipers. So they were fastened on, there were 10 men fastened on the hilltop, what could do nothing. They couldn't expose themselves, they were getting shot at the whole time. We down the lee side of the hill were calling to them. So the officer made the decision, who was Captain Daniels, to send for Sergeant Buckley. Buckley was an incredibly good 2-inch mortarman, a sergeant mortarman. He was sent for, was Sergeant Buckley, and the idea was for him to send up as many smoke bombs as quickly as possible to shroud the hilltop in smoke to get the men out of this fatal position that they were in, because we were on a hilltop which was looked over by a commanding height like Kamaksan, and Kamaksan stands 3,000 feet above sea level, so they were in a terrible position. Buckley came up and he did his job, and in 2 minutes he dropped something like 6 or 9 smoke bombs in rapid fire, 2-inch smoke bombs, onto the hilltop, and as soon as the smoke cloud rose, all the men were shouted to come off the situation. They came out through the smoke. They came out through a hail of bullets, I must say, but not one of them were hit because they were under the cover of smoke. And that situation was unredeemable. Unredeemable. And we were taken from that position back to the MSR, down to the bottom of the hill, and we were put in positions on the saddle. The idea on the saddle was that the two battalions up front, which were the Ulster Rifles and the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, should each in turn come down the valley to our positions through us, and we then would come out ourselves. B Company would come out itself on the backs of the Centurion tanks. But this never happened, because the men, the two battalions were coming back in staggered positions, in section, coming back, and the Chinese were on the commanding positions on each side of the hill, and they were just picking them off like shooting clay pigeons. And that was the majority of the casualties on the Imjin River were sustained on that valley floor. And then the Chinese, two Centurion tanks. One had lost the track. By the time it got the track back on, the idea was for us to jump on the tanks and to make an exit that way when everybody had come through us. But as I say, that just didn't happen. There were carnage on the valley floor. The CO of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, a man, the Mayor, Lieutenant Colonel Kingsley Foster, he came onto our positions, and as the men were coming straggling through our positions, he was detailing men off to form sections to send them up the hill to stop this hail of fire coming down from the hilltops. And then he was killed in a rake of fire, was Colonel Foster, and we got an order, it's every man for themselves. So we beat a retreat down the same valley in the same way as the men were going. A lot of men jumped onto the two existing Centurion tanks. We were in a dried up riverbed on the left hand side of the MSR, and the two Centurion tanks loaded with men, a corporal from my platoon, Corporal Bill Lorimer, was hung onto one tank. The first tank was spread with machine gun fire by the Chinese. The men fell off onto the ground and were run over by the second tank. The remains of my platoon were in the dried up riverbed, and the screaming from the men flattened to the road by the second tank were horrendous. We went onto the road, there was 10 of us. We went onto the road, and the Chinese were so dense in number that there were so many rifles pointing at us, there was just nothing we could do. It were in a futile, fatal, futile situation. There were just so many tanks, we had nothing else to do but to just drop us weapons. And the Chinese officer, in his wisdom, the screaming was horrendous, and he went and sprayed the lads stuck to the ground. How many there were just killed there, I just do not know, but there were a substantial number. And he sprayed the lads, the screaming stopped, and we were captive.
Now, people sometimes say to me, how accurate can people's memories be after 50 years? Do you think that your memories of that you've just described to me are accurate?
Very much so. It has never left me. Never left me. Never left me at all. And there is other people who have documented the same experience.
What date were you captured?
On the 25th of April, 1951.
And in the battle, how frightening was it? Were you...
Well, it's not an hilarious situation. Or there's something happening where one does create laughter. The majority of people in my platoon were reservists, Second World War reservists, who had done 6 years in World War II. So they were very experienced men. And there were just four national servicemen. I would say out of the 10 men captured, there were just four national servicemen, and the other remainder were all experienced regular soldiers who had completed 6 years experience in 39-45. But the thing about being captured is you see immediately life on the other side. And it also gives you an insight when you're being taken back into captivity over the Yim Jim River. It gives you an insight into the power, firepower, administrated against the oncoming Chinese troops. The number of Chinese dead were horrendous, which we saw. And also, it also showed us that we were defeated by not a mechanically technological army, but an army what could just purely move quick, had bolt-action rifles, and nothing else greater than mortars. We were not defeated by artillery. We were just defeated by sheer weight of numbers. You also saw on our movement back to be kept just a mile behind the Yim Jim River that the horrendous piles of dead Chinese, because they clean up straight away. There's so many people in the Chinese army with 30,000 men. They must have had 15,000 casualties dead, at least, if not greater. It's very hard to assess the numbers. But there was piles and piles of dead, 8 foot high, in great clumps of 10, 15 foot wide, just dead bodies. And they just used to pile them up and burn them. And the Chinese soldier itself, the foot soldier, was horrendous, in as much that he didn't have any tackling. They didn't have the technology of wirelesses. They shout at commands from one to another. Whereas as a battalion of Chinese men were moving forward, immediately a man dug a foxhole and sat in that foxhole. When he heard an oncoming airplane, he would shout, "Fungola," and it went to a man 25 yards away, and he shouted the same language and passed on the message. Everything was verbally transported in command. There was no collection. People didn't carry, like every section carried a radio man in the British Army. They didn't have this. They didn't have tanks. They didn't have artillery. They just had bloody sheer volume of men. And those men were so deployed when we were moving back, being taken back in captivity, the hills were swarming. And I mean literally swarming. As soon as a Sabre jet came over, everybody, they were masters of camouflage. Everybody stayed still, shrunk under leaves and God knows what. And no doubt the speed that they were travelling up, they couldn't see half of them. But it was incredible. The Chinese soldier, he carried a bandolier about 3 inch wide, and it was a cotton sack, and it went right round his body and coupled together here in one big loop. And we wondered what it was. We'd been fed on C rations, C6, C7s, which was a box, a cardboard box, the side of a boot box, and in it was everything for one day. It had three main courses. It had sweet biscuits, toilet paper, cigarettes, tin openers, everything. It was the most compact thing one had ever seen in your life. Yet the Chinese soldier, he went into war for 5 days with this tube of ground rice and soya beans and everything in it, and all he needed was a drop of water, and he would spoon this dry compound, this dry mash, and that sustained him for 5 days. And so he could move, and he didn't wear big boots, what held him down, kit, pouches, haversacks, and everything on his back. He travelled light. All he had was his food sack and his two bandoliers and a pouch behind him with 5 stick bombs in, 200 rounds of ammunition and a bloody rifle. He didn't even have a tin hat or nothing. But he could move so fast, it was unbelievable.
How did the people who captured you treat you at first?
Well, of course, we were frontline soldiers, the most terrible people to meet, because they are the people who are marred by battle. The lots of the Chinese, we noticed, were constantly scarred with brown burn marks, because the most horrendous thing they faced was napalm. And these people have been treated by napalm and not given to being generous and commit acts of nice humanitarian practice. It didn't do to upset them, because they'd just shot you and look at you. But that's the way frontline troops are. Behind, when we were kept in the Yingjim area for 3 weeks in dugouts. Now, we wondered when we were doing the big sweeps of 20 miles into enemy territory, we could see no Chinese whatsoever. But obviously they'd been there, because they kept us in dugouts. Our dugout was a deep ditch outside of the road, which had had fir trees put over the top for camouflage. We were made to stay in there, and they consequently, we were not allowed out until twilight, and we were allowed out next morning at early dawn, and that's the only time we were allowed to move. In between times, nobody was allowed to move at all, because the speed which the Sabre jets, F-86s, travelled, they were only before the noise came. And so nobody were allowed to move about in daylight. And they were able to keep us in that situation for 3 weeks before the march to the north. And then when the march was north, of course, we could only march at night. And now the strange thing about it was the frontline troops were well equipped in as much that every man had a rifle. But as one moved further back, it was very noticeable that all the men coming down to the front to replenish the stores at the front didn't have rifles. Men moved in great bands, Chinese men, completely without armaments whatsoever. So it just tells you that the limited number of armaments and weapons they had. But nevertheless, there's no affinity. We are Caucasian in description and they're Mongoloid. And there's no way that one can move among the other or escape because you just stand out like a chap lap peg.
Did you run foul yourself of your captors at first?
Well, I lost all my private belongings, in as much as I lost my cigarette cases and my wallet and things with my personal pictures of my wife and, you know, family. They were all taken off as booty and loot. Although some people said that theirs were kept and given back to them, but it never applied to me. There was lots of our wear and our clothing which the Chinese wanted. They took what they wanted. One can't argue with frontline troops.
What did you lose?
Well, I lost my windjammer and I lost my battle dress. I had a windjammer over it. And apart from that, no hotels. And my personal belongings, of course. And the marched us back north. We were hoping that they didn't have enough food to feed us. And there had been rumours before when we were in the line that the Chinese didn't take prisoners. They all sent them back. So we were hoping it'd apply to us, but in this case it didn't. They'd taken nearly 600 Gloucesters, and they had quite 150 of us out of the Northumberland, out of the IORs, and there were also the same number of the Northumberland Fusiliers. And they decided to keep us as a bargaining piece. And they marched us back north after, I would say, 3 weeks in the dugout.
Were any of them able to say anything to you in a language which you could understand?
Quite a few Chinese. It's surprising the number what can speak broken English, but nobody on our side could speak broken Chinese. But it is a fact that everywhere in the world you go, there's always somebody to speak English.
What type of things were they saying to you?
Well, they were just... they didn't start interrogations. You know, it was just casual chatter. The first thing that one learns is not for food, but it's tobacco. Something about tobacco which is international. And they had they formed their cigarettes from something called tambi, and it was the wild-grown tobacco. And they would give you little bits of tambi and show you how to form in a piece of paper and smoke a cigarette. That's the first thing they ever gave you. One was never bothered about food because the Chinese troops didn't eat like we do. They ate this dry bran. So consequently, the only thing they could feed us in that frontline situation was with the same dry bran. And that takes an awful lot of adapting to. An awful lot. It took, I would say, 6 to 7 months to adapt our metabolism and bodies to adapt to the food that they ate.
In what way?
You know,
just to digest it?
To digest it and to find it palatable. One has really got to be hungry. You see, we carry such things as nourishment bars, don't we? Chocolate and the likes of. They have no such things. As soon as they saw the chocolate, if one had chocolate, they took it off you. Because they were seeing a luxury that they were not used to. And it took a long time for them to... we never got fully adapted until we got to the camp.
What was the journey north like?
Well, the journey north, when they decided to do it, was quite an experience. As we left the frontline situation, we approached a place called Hellfire Pass. Now, L5 Blast was a gap through the mountains, which the American light aircraft kept constantly under surveillance. The pass would be about 2 miles long. We were put into threes by the Chinese and told to head to keep going for at least 2 miles, and then there would be Chinese on the other side of L5 Pass. If the flares dropped, we had to lay down straight away. Well, we all knew the crack about that. And there was no point in running because the people in the aircraft, when they saw movement, dropped bombs. So it was to our advantage to survive, to obey the rules as per Chinese Army. As soon as the flares dropped, everybody fell to the ground. We were set off in 2 minute gaps in blocks of three. And the object was to get to the gap in the hills, which we could see 2 miles away in the shapes. The twilight was quite strong. This was created by the fact that when we were in the front line, we had a big searchlight which cast its main beam onto the enemy, and it created a false twilight. It allowed you to see things. And that searchlight was still in operation when we were captured by the Chinese, or whether or not it were the Americans who moved a bit farther back. That false twilight was still in operation. So we could see quite a distance, and quite a few flares were dropped the period of time we were in the L5 Pass. And the idea was to run from one side to the other till you got through. And everybody got through without anybody being killed. I should say we'd be about 200 in our column. We marched all night from sundown to sunup. And then at sunup, we were put under trees for camouflage, and we had to sleep during the day. And then just before we set off on the next march, they will bring out the dry bran, and you try and eat some dry bran. After L5 Pass, the food started to run out, and we had a 3 day period when we had to stock up with dry bran, and we weren't going to be fed for the following 3 days. And in order to achieve that, when you've nothing to put the dry bran in, what we found, we could tear the sleeves off as khaki shirts and tie the knot at the bottom of the cuffs and fill the arm piece with dry bran. And it was just enough to sustain it because we didn't eat a lot. Our bodies couldn't adapt to it. Men were losing weight substantially then, and men were getting weaker because we weren't sustained by good food. If one had to look at it, say you were a Chinese prisoner being taken prisoner by the Americans, whose standard of food was so good, they, on a scale of 1 to 10, they had a 1 to 10 improvement, but we had a diminishment of nourishment, and we just found it hard to adapt.
What happened next after you got through Hellfire Pass?
Well, Hellfire Pass brought us on to, we had another week to a week and a half marching at night. And we got to what was known as Halfway House. And we were allowed to stay in a schoolroom, a big schoolroom, which had survived the bombing just outside Pyongyang, and we stayed in the schoolroom for a week to recuperate. And then we started the second half of our trip up to the Yellow River, where we stayed in a place called Chongsong. But after Pyongyang, we marched during the day because the air activity was not as busy as in the frontline situation. There were two occasions on the march when we were strafed. We were strafed by Sabre jets, but they wouldn't know the hell we were, and they just blew a strafing down the middle of the road, and all we did was dive into the ditch on the other side. We all survived. The thing the reason the Sabre jets did not come back. See, Sabre jets did most of their battles with MiGs up on the Yellow River, and the Sabre jets, we were to find out later, they would get to the Yellow River and then jettison, we used to see them jettison their spare tanks, which they flow down the flange about 35,000 feet. And then they only had enough juice in the tanks to be in contact with MiGs for 20 minutes. And then that were particular and critical. Then they had to make a way on because they'd only enough juice to get back to the Suwon landing bases. And as the seat come down, they'd be seeing us watching up. They'd be able to see us and fire the blast off, but they wouldn't be able to retaliate and turn around and come back and give us another strafing because they'd never had enough juice. So we knew when they were coming back down at us from the north, the Sabre jets, they were on the way home and didn't have a lot of manoeuvrability. So we were quite safe. And we marched all through for another week and a half before we got to the Yellow River. And we stayed at Cheongsong then for the remaining 2.5 years.
Any contact with Korean villagers?
Very little. They didn't. Korean villagers were not compatible to us at all because they were taking such horrendous night bombing that they were not they were not friendly in any shape or form. And we were advised by the Chinese and all, albeit whether or not it were common sense, we found it were common sense, that we had a better chance of survival with Chinese than what we had with Koreans.
What was it like at Cheongsong?
Well, Cheongsong was not a very good place. It had very, very poor sanitation. There was about 800 to 1,000 Americans there when we got there, and the two columns of British troops converged on Cheongsong, and it made a number of about 2,000. The sanitation was non-existent. Americans died in great numbers. They suffered from a disease called gibbonitis. The American system of army is not as friendly and as good as the English battalion method. Men in battalions are compatriots and they look after each other. In the American forces, there doesn't seem to be this esprit de corps and camaraderie. Mainly because, maybe it's because the country's so vast. The men didn't help themselves and help each other like the British troops did. Also, the majority of those men had been captured in the January. Now, this was April, and they'd had some terrible conditions to put up with. They were emaciated. It was like walking into Belsen. And dysentery was rife. It was also rife among the English troops as well, among the British troops. And also we had a number of about 20 Turkish troops taken prisoner at the same time. They joined us on the march up. A substantial number of Filipinos. They survived well, but the Americans did not survive well. The first day in that camp, I saw personally 15 trips up Boot Hill with dead Americans. And then the number went up to 25.